I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell, and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you so much for listening. It's a real joy, a privilege. I feel it every time we record, Mo.
It is a privilege.
It's extraordinary.
For lots of reasons.
Yes.
Privilege for me to get to do this with you.
It's a privilege for me to get to do it with you.
And it's a privilege to do it and that people like to listen.
Yes, and we get nice messages. Have we had any good Instagrams this week?
Was getting good Instagrams. Guys, what I really want is to get the followers, Instagram followers, up to 1,000. Currently we are at, let me check, 800 and something.
Well, please tell your friends. I'm afraid I don't know how to work it.
You don't know how to work it, so it's moot.
I'm not...
We have 881 followers.
Oh, we only got 120 to go.
Exactly.
Well done. Isn't that great?
But I posted the video of Betsy coming up the stairs to see you.
That's good.
That went down an absolute charm.
Oh, wonderful, darling. Wonderful.
That's had 466 views. Betsy is adorbs. This is the cutest.
Yeah.
Beautiful Betsy. I mean, Betsy basically gets the most attention.
We're way below
we're
that.
We're way below.
Yeah, we don't have fur.
Way below.
In my case, I don't even have hair.
No. Well, I don't think that's the only thing stopping us being cuter than Betsy. she's the queen.
She is. Absolutely right.
She is the queen. She is on good form. She's here with us today. And every record.
Every record.
She loves coming to see you.
And she also used to go to lunch when we were still going to lunch before.
The video footage of Betsy at lunch has been posted on the Instagram before too. But yes, sadly we are not at Joe Allen.
No.
But we've made a new routine.
A new routine. Which
we're in each other's bubble.
We are, and we stick in it.
And we come here and we record and then we have lunch.
Yeah.
And I taught Dad how to use Deliveroo.
Yes, my word. It's wonderful.
You love it, don't you?
It's wonderful. It's absolutely terrific.
And we're really lucky because Geoffrey lives in a very good location, so we can order from this restaurant called Hoppers, which is widely regarded as one of the sort of top, I would say, 5 restaurants in London. It does Sri Lankan food. It's curry and...
It's extremely good.
Geoffrey is very keen.
It really is. Best Indian food I think I've ever had. And I've been to some of these smart ones in Mayfair, like Gymkhana.
We can get delivery from Gymkhana, but we can't afford it.
Well,
it's the most expensive restaurant in the world.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know. And people are competing to get in. I mean, when I went there, was very kindly taken there by a friend... Oh, crowds.
Same to get into Hoppers, though. There's no reservations at Hoppers. It's first come, first served. If you want to go, you've got to get there dead on 12:30. That's the key.
Okay.
And they're in Soho. I don't know, on Frith Street.
Frith Street, yes.
And because of COVID, they've put, and obviously they won't be able to do this, but they put all their tables on the street. So they've been serving people outside because it's quite small. Another of my favourite restaurants, I miss my favourite restaurants so much. Another of my favourite restaurants is on Frith Street. It's called Koya Bar. And it's a Japanese noodle restaurant where you sit at very low stools around the bar and they make the food. They serve udon there. And they serve lots of other things, but it's kind of
like... You've been to Japan, haven't you?
I have been to Japan,
yes,
yeah.
You liked it.
I love Japan. I would like to go again.
I've tried to go to Japan... when my West book was published there in Japanese. The Japanese publishers...
We should do a Japanese... Dad watched Giri Haji during...
yes, I did.
Lockdown, which is a really good drama that was on Netflix. I'm not sure if it's still on there. Very good, set in between the UK and Japan.
Yes.
It's very good.
Very good.
Probably one of my favourite things. We've probably talked about it before.
Yeah, but it is very, very good.
Yeah. We should do a Japanese murder.
We should, perhaps. Yes.
Mum knows the boy, a man, who worked, he was working with, in a bank or something, and he worked directly with the guy that put the women in the bath on the balcony.
Covered it with sand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we should look into that. I would be interested to do that.
Yes, we will. We'll have a little look.
Anyway, so you'll remember last week we did part one of Dennis Nielsen. Therefore, what will be happening today is part two. Dennis Nielsen, part two.
Well, as you will remember, this is a man who was a cook in the army, then a Metropolitan policeman, then worked as a clerk in a job centre in Denmark Street. Lonely, filled with his own fantasies, and you might say, and I don't think it would be unfair, rather arrogant. He was a strangely arrogant man, given the fact that he was really not very significant. He didn't look very remarkable. Pretty dull, to be honest. But then we have these images of serial killers, don't we, based in America, where they all got horns and they're all 8 foot tall.
No, you say that. They don't look like they do. They never do.
No, they don't. But I think it's worth remembering when we come to Nielsen, and I'll come to the killings in a minute. When he wrote his autobiography, which the Home Office refused to allow him to publish, History of a Drowning Man, which I did refer to in the first... he made the following remark in the book. I would have found it impossible to kill anyone I knew because the object was not to find sexual relief through killing as an end in itself, but to secure a passive body so the sexual frisson could be achieved through a power-passive ritual.
Power-passive.
He particularly liked the image of holding a body between the knees, knees over this arm,
mm-hmm.
head on this side,
mm-hmm.
in front of a mirror.
Okay.
Usually
while
naked.
What does power-passive mean?
Mm.
Power-passive. Maybe he just didn't like the other person's response, as it were.
Well, the first victim was a 14-year-old boy called Stephen Holmes, whom Nielsen met in the Crickled Arms pub, not far from Melrose Avenue. And he invited him back to Melrose Avenue. This is very much the pattern of the events. They drank a lot. He strangled the boy eventually and drowned him in a bucket of water just to prove that he would make sure that he was dead. And then he went through the ritual that he was to go through many other times, which was to bathe the body and keep it. This boy, this first victim, as far as we know, wasn't dismembered, but he nevertheless... the only one not to be. He was kept alive for various sexual experiments.
Not alive.
I'm sorry, forgive me. The body was kept.
Yeah.
For a series of sexual experiments and was eventually put under the floorboards of 195 Melrose Avenue.
How does that work with like a putrefaction?
Well, remember Christie put bodies under the floorboards in Rillington Place?
No, I know, yeah.
It's not unknown.
No.
Because you have these plaths, like, you know...
And would it be, like, straight down into the earth down there?
No, it's almost certainly under the foundations, and then there would be wood.
Is it like the crawl space where Gacy put
Gacy.
His ones?
It's much more like that, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't quite know why, but for a whole year, Nielsen did not kill again. He kept the body under the floorboards and occasionally took it out.
It would just turn into liquid.
Well, eventually, but not quickly.
Mm.
Takes much longer time to decompose than you'd think.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it depends on the temperatures and environment and stuff like that.
Anyway,
really quite
on the
cold
3rd
down
of
there.
The 3rd of December 1979, he met a man called Kenneth Ockenden, who was 23. He was Canadian and he was a tourist. Once again, they met in a pub and Nielsen offered to show him round London, which he duly did, and then invited him back to Melrose Avenue. This was one of the few victims who wasn't homeless or gay. Ockenden was invited back to Melrose Avenue, very much the same, an awful lot of drink. Nielsen would strangle him while he was pretty much unconscious. But this time he took Polaroids of the dead body for his own later amusement, and he put him under the floorboards but retrieved him four times, again with this ritual of holding the body.
Is that something that's the other people do that?
I've never heard of it before. I think it's important. I'll read again Nielsen's own words. My rituals in handling the body are replete with the continuity of mirrors, very much Nielsen's very elaborate, slightly pseudo-intellectual phrasing. Mm-hmm. My undressing, etc., were nearly always, as was practical, best viewed by me through a mirror while I was doing it. My highest peak of frisson was to stand before a full-length mirror with the orange side lights on, naked, holding the body naked in my arms. You're looking a bit bemused.
I'm just trying to work out why that would happen, why you would do that.
Well, we spin forward now to May 1980, and the third victim, a young man of 16 called Martin Duffy, who was a runaway from Birkenhead and who was picked up by Melrose at a railway station almost...
By Nielsen.
Sorry. was picked up, sorry, it's been that kind of week.
Don't worry.
Was picked up by Nielsen. At a railway station, almost certainly Euston. Taken back to Melrose Avenue, plied with drink, strangled, and drowned in the kitchen sink. Once again, that body was put beneath the floorboards of Melrose Avenue. A few months later, in August, and I'm sorry about this litany, forgive me, but it's...
Just saying it like it is, Dad.
In August 1980, Nielsen strangled a man called William Sutherland, who was 26 and from Edinburgh. He was a father of one, incidentally, but he was also a male prostitute. And, I don't know, fell into Nielsen's grasp. If I say that Nielsen was incredibly ordinary to look at, I mean, literally... commonplace, and I'm quite sure that David Tennant in the drama will demonstrate that there was nothing striking. He wasn't charismatic in any way, as some serial killers can be, but he was just almost beige, you know, nothing really, bland, but he was deadly. Now things get a little bit more, how can one put it, of a hurry. Between the death of Sutherland in August 1980 and the end of 1980, Nielsen kills another four people. Almost all of them remain unidentified. He couldn't remember their names later. One was an Irish labourer. One was a prostitute. May have been between 20 or 30, could have been Filipino, might be Mexican. They met in the Salisbury Arms in St Martin's Lane, a very famous gay pub in the old days. And then in November, there was an English vagrant he'd found sleeping rough on the Charing Cross Road. He said, "Would you like a lift?" And he got in a taxi and took him back to Melrose Avenue. I'm sorry. I mean, the poor man must have thought his ship had come in.
Yeah.
Again, strangled as he slept. Nielsen, by this point, is saying to himself, killing is as easy as taking candy from a baby.
Well, he must think it. It's a bit mad, isn't it? It's, we've talked about that before, when you must get the kind of God complex thing where you're like, I'm doing this and getting away with it. So you stop realizing what the value of human life is.
Well, he was getting a bit crowded in Melrose Avenue. So Nielsen comes up with a plan. He's going to burn the bodies in the garden.
I mean, not the sharpest tool in the toolbox, is he?
And hang on a moment. He decides he's going to put a tyre on top of the bodies to disguise the smell. It was a terrible smell if you burn a tyre. Black smoke.
And if you burn a body.
And then he would rake through the remains to make sure there was no identifier. On one occasion...
No fillings and wedding rings.
On one occasion he came... I'm sorry, sometimes I have to laugh a little bit. He came across a skull after one of these burnings and he smashed it with his rake because he didn't want there to be a skull in the garden.
Oh, God.
Well, in his mindset, he was doing the right thing. He was fulfilling his fantasy.
Hmm.
And I know it's difficult to conceive, but yes, it was. And throughout his period in Melrose Avenue, he committed 3 bonfires, all in all. And then in the first weeks of 1981, he picked up an 18-year-old Scot in the Golden Lion pub in Soho. Now, I've slightly sanitise some of this because Nielsen also, in these earlier killings, dissected some of the bodies and certainly at some point removed some of the internal organs, which he put in black bags and dumped over the fence at the bottom of his garden, presumably so the foxes could have them. But as far as anybody knew, he was still a civil servant working in the job centre in Denmark Street. It almost defies belief, really. At least it defies my belief.
I suppose that's a thing as well about going after people who've like run away or homeless or, you know, nobody's looking for you.
No. It's the same argument people have often used about killing prostitutes, isn't it?
Because it's a transient
community. And they might just have gone off to ply their trade somewhere else.
That didn't happen, though, with those women in Ipswich, because they did all get together and realise that something was up.
They did. They did.
And they looked out for each other.
Then in February 1981, there's a boy in his early 20s, probably from Belfast, strangled, put under the floorboards. In April 81, a young English skinhead with a tattoo around his neck saying, "Cut here." He's strangled. And Nielsen by now is adapting his behaviour slightly. This time he hung the naked torso in his bedroom for 24 hours before putting it under the floorboards. Another victim at this point he slept with, a naked lying on top of him.
That is revolting.
And another, he would get up from the floorboards, under the floorboards, and put in the armchair beside him while he watched television.
So he's so gross and so weird.
But that's what I mean. You are living in a totally parallel universe here. 195 Melrose Avenue was a different world. He could do what he wanted, as you quite rightly point out. In fact, he kept these... Well, Brian Master's book about Nielsen is called Killing for Company, and that's one explanation. There are a set of other explanations, but that's certainly one explanation. He liked to have them around, and he liked knowing they were under the
floorboards. Because he was lonely.
Yeah. He was a rather sad man. But then, in May 1982, his landlord decides to refurbish 195 Melrose Avenue and asks Nielsen to leave. So now Nielsen has got a double problem. So he prolongs. He says, no, I'm not. So the landlord gives him £1,000 to go, by which time, of course, Nielsen's managed to organise another bonfire for the remaining fragments that are left under the floorboards of 195 Melrose Avenue. In fact, if there is a turning point in this case, it's the end of Melrose Avenue. Because Nielsen leaves and in October 1981, he moves into Cranley Gardens, an attic flat at number 23D, Cranley Gardens in Muswell Hill, not far from Highgate Woods. I knew it well because when I was at school, I used to go on the bus past it quite often. It was a perfectly ordinary suburban street, and he had the attic. Now, the problem with the attic, of course, is you can't
hide bodies in it.
You can't put bodies under the floorboards. So Nielsen has a long think about this, but finally can't stop himself. And the first victim at Cranley Gardens on the 18th of September 1981 is called Malcolm Barlow, and he was 23. He was the last victim at Melrose Avenue, forgive me. He was an epileptic that Nielsen had helped, and the body was stored in the kitchen cupboard before being dissected. There was no room under the floorboards, and he formed the last of the bonfires. Spin forward, he moves house to 23D Cranley Gardens, and in March 1982 kills John Howlett, who was 23, once again strangled as he slept, and then his head is held under water in the bath for 5 minutes. He's dismembered, and parts of the body are flushed down the loo. Not, as you remarked earlier, the brightest boy in the block, despite his rather wonderful flowery language. He explained it, actually. It's quite funny. He explained why he put them under the floorboards. I didn't own a car, nor did I drive. Otherwise, I'd have taken the bodies out to the country in the boot and buried them without any recourse to dissection. I thought it would attract too much attention to be seen digging full-size graves in my back garden.
I mean, yeah, it would have been.
Well, I mean, he also said...
But people have done it.
Yeah.
Many times.
Oh dear. He also remarked that there were certain people that in ideal conditions he would have liked to have kept in chemicals, like the hands.
Like Dharma.
Not unlike Dharma. My circumstances being so limited confined such thoughts to the realms of idealistic dreams. He also insisted, and I think this was self-delusion, to be honest, that if only he'd had the right kind of drug, he wouldn't necessarily have had to kill them.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, we've talked about that before. Like, if there'd been Rohypnol or whatever.
Yeah, GHB.
Yeah, he would have just...
But...
It doesn't sound like it from all that stuff that he did afterwards.
No, and it didn't really. It's extraordinary. Anyway, let's go back to Cranley Gardens. In September 1982, he picked up a man. This is the 14th victim, a man called Graham Allen, who was 27. He picked him up in Shaftesbury Avenue and yet again said, "Oh, would you like to come back for a drink?" And he got in a taxi and went to Melrose Avenue. Sorry, Cranley Gardens.
Hmm.
This one was strangled while he was eating an omelette that Nielsen had prepared for him. Clearly went behind him.
Mm. Would have thought it. Yeah, okay.
Parts of his body were also flushed down the loo. And on the 26th of January, 1983, Nielsen killed a young man called Stephen Sinclair, who was a heroin addict from Scotland. Again, strangled with a ligature. Head, upper body, upper torso and arms stored in a tea chest, which he kept in the living room of Cranley Gardens. Well, if you like black humour, this story has it. In February 1983, before, just not long after he'd killed Sinclair, he complained to the estate agent that he'd rented Cranley Gardens from about a blockage to the drains.
He complained himself?
He complained himself.
Oh, my God. I thought someone else complained.
No, he complained. Believe it or not, a dino rod man came round on the 8th of February 1983 to look at the drains. And he found what looks like flesh-like substance.
Oh, my God, that's so gross. Poor guy.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that because he doesn't think it can't be, you know. Anyway, he goes to see Nielsen and says, oh, I think somebody's been flushing their Kentucky Fried Chicken down the loo. The man doesn't really believe that. Anyway, he decides to come back the following day with his supervisor. When he gets back the following day, Nielsen's obviously done some sort of attempt to clear up the mess. But it's not a very good attempt, because if you look further up the pipes, there are more what is clearly human remains. There might even be, you know, there's a part of a torso which got ligature marks. But here begins what I think is the most remarkable element of this, in many ways, horrific story. The police are informed by the Dino Rod team, and DCI Peter James and two colleagues visit Nielsen. They knock on the door and they say, oh, I'm Detective Chief Inspector James. We've come to talk to you about the drains. And Nielsen looks, what about the drains? Well, we found what we think might be human remains. Oh, dear. So at the start, Nielsen says, but then, of course, they say, could we come in? Well, Nielsen has not simply been putting things down the drains. He's been boiling the heads in a large pot in his kitchen in Cranley Gardens. And he's got all manner of body parts in all sorts of places.
Oh, my goodness. They must have thought they'd walked into a horror shop.
Yeah, yeah. Where's the rest of the body, they said. Nielsen says. Yes. Well, and I think this is my favourite moment in the story, which I'm sure will be good in the drama. Nielsen says to them finally, it's a long story, but I'll tell you when we go to the police station. So they get into the car to take him to the police station. Bear in mind, he's been in the police himself. And the driver says to him, well, how many people have you killed then? And he says, matter-of-factly, 15 or so. And they don't think, come on, don't we? You look like a clerk. Is it now an executive officer in the Kentish Town Job Centre?
Mm.
Yeah, risen in the world, supervising authority. I can't believe it. I mean, it's ridiculous. But then Nielsen goes into the most elaborate details. And, of course, they search Cranley Gardens. And they go back to Melrose Avenue and do a minute analysis of the garden. It's perfectly obvious that Nielsen is telling the truth. Mm. Though it must have struck all the detectives that dealt with him as almost beyond imagining that this is a man who's not only killed these people, but he's butchered them. It takes them some time to cotton to the fact that he was a chef in the army. And what I think also struck them was this kind of, almost as if he's not associated with any of these actions. That's when I was in this dreamlike state. And when I went to the job centre, it was different. I was different.
Yeah.
It was, you know, complete dissociation between fantasy and reality. In his autobiography, he suggests that if he had indeed drowned, you may recall,
mm-hmm.
Off the coast of Scotland, perhaps that would have been better for him. Lives would ultimately have been saved. You could say my survival was an injustice. Originally, Nielsen was simply going to plead guilty. There were effectively six charges of murder and two of attempted murder. I've slightly gone round the two attempted murders because both men escaped with their lives and indeed gave evidence against Nielsen at his trial. In the end, Nielsen changed his plea to not guilty by reason of diminished responsibility. His trial began in October 1983, and it was a sensation at the Old Bailey, because the gruesomeness, the sheer horror of this man's actions, as were laid out in court. He was prosecuted by Alan Green, one later to become Director of Public Prosecutions, a man I knew quite well, defended by Ivan Lawrence. It was a show trial, a big deal, very dramatic. And the jury, it's very interesting. You go back and look at what the jury did. In the end, he was only found guilty by a majority verdict on the six murders, but it was found and one attempted. But there was an absolute guilty, unanimous guilty verdict on the other attempted murder, who had given evidence against him. And he was sentenced to life with a minimum of 25 years. It was quite clear to Nielsen and to everybody else that he was never going to get out of prison. And indeed, remained in prison. Finally in HMP Full Sutton in the north of England until he died in May 2018 at the age of 72. Nielsen will forever be regarded as a monster. I think it's odd. There was a great deal going on in Nielsen's mind. He was a monster. There can't be any doubt about that. But there was this strange other life that inhabited him. I mean, we talk about serial killers like Gacy or, you know, the American serial killers. They all have a sort of fit pattern, and it's all about the sex. It wasn't about the sex. Almost no penetration ever took place. There's a very special word for it, which I can never remember, but it involves the thighs. But it was a lot of masturbation, sure. But then he kept the bodies, or cut them up and kept the bodies.
Well, that the sort of sexual arousal could still be a motive.
Oh, I'm sure there's an element of that. Absolutely right, darling. But there is the story of Dennis Nielsen.
Wow, that was pretty full on.
Sorry.
No, thank you very much. That was Dennis Nielsen, part two. Well, I shall be interested to watch the dramatisation.
Me too, very much so.
And see, we thought this was a timely time to tell it, so you can all watch.
Yes, because, of course, if you're not in Britain, you won't be able to see it yet, but I'm sure it'll come.
Eventually.
It's Tennant is a wonderful actor, and it's a very interesting part.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many nuances to it, you know, and it isn't just, you know, horrid man with a tail and horns hiding in the cupboard. It's, you know, a chap working in a job centre.
Yeah.
Who's picking up homeless or gay or random people.
Fascinating. Well, thank you very much.
We all just end up on something a bit more cheerful, shouldn't we? I mean,
yeah, probably.
Quite hard to change
gear. Oh, wait, we need to remind you all to check out our Patreon page, which will be going live next week.
Okay.
But we will also talk about it on next week.
Next week too, yes. Yeah. We'll do that.
Oh, yes, that's what I was meant to ask, and I've forgotten. I've only just remembered. If you are still listening, hopefully you are, and you are keen on the Patreon and you like the idea, can you let us know anything that you would really like to see on there?
Absolutely.
Any kind of extra features or anything?
Yeah.
What, you know, and also just, you know, any ideas that you guys have, not just for subjects, but yeah, anything you'd like on the Patreon, like what bonus footage could we give? Would you be interested in hearing us talk about anything else, or me talking to Jeffrey about his other work? And, you know, there's lots of things that we could do.
Absolutely. So,
all ideas, very welcome.
Very, very welcome. And that applies to everybody, whether they're on Patreon or not.
Everybody, anything you think whether we
you
should
can,
do.
And you can how do you contact us again?
You can reach us through Instagram, which is BloodTies_pod. I do that. And then we also have a Facebook page, Blood Ties Podcast Facebook page, and Twitter, BloodTies_pod. And we have an email, bloodties.podcast@gmail.com. And through Jeffrey's website, you can find him.
Yeah, if you Google me, you can get my email. And yeah. I pass them on to Mo. No, it's very, I think it's very exciting. I like more feedback.
Yeah, we love feedback.
You know, more the merrier, to be honest.
Apart from all the people who say my voice is horrible on the iTunes reviews.
Not, I've never heard such nonsense.
Jeffrey's told me, obviously, not to read the bad reviews, but guys, is this the way I speak? I didn't choose it.
Well, I didn't choose the way I speak either, darling.
I know. Just, there you go.
It just happens.
Some people are like, why is Molly putting on that stupid girly voice?
And I'm like, that's her real voice.
How I sound.
That's how she sounds. I promise you. But as I've told you before, never read reviews.
I know.
Even the good ones.
I know.
Don't read them.
I know. But if you would like to combat that, you could go on to the Apple podcast thing and write us some reviews and give us some 5 stars and push all of the ones with my about me having a funny voice down to the bottom. That
I think you I don't care. I think your voice is great.
Thanks, Dad.
And I think it's part of the charm of this, that it's you and I.
It's a unique.
Yes, well, it's really part of what we do, you know. It's
our USP.
It's really important.
Thank you to all the people that help us, our producer Sam Brain, my brother Dan who does the music, my friend George who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for doing all of the hard work and tiring out his own brain, and to all of you listeners, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you so much. It's an absolute privilege, as I said at the beginning, to be with you, and Molly and I much, much appreciate it. And as I often say, bad things happen to good people, so do be careful out there.